Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. Hope you're well. I am here with one of the best traders on the planet Earth right now. And regardless of what's been happening lately, he is here to talk about all the things that he's done well and the things that he's learned and maybe some of the mistakes that he's made and what we can learn from that to become better investors and traders ourselves. Really needs no introduction. Harris Cooperman, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist channel.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's going to be fun. I've listened to you for a long time. I'm excited to do this.
Well, we're both really good friends with Chris McIntosh. You know, I wish that he had more of a public profile or so. You know, I know he's on Twitter a lot, but people just, he needs to be on Real Vision. He needs to be on, he needs to have a bigger voice, I think.
I agree.
He's just an incredible mind, and I think people need to have more access to his ideas.
He's called everything, 3 or 4 years ahead of what was going to happen now. Since I've known him, I've known him about 15 years. He's always he has the roadmap, and he knows how to play. Yeah. And it's just amazing how he's been able to call it,
Yeah, between him and Lynn Ald, and Lynn, and they're a little bit different. I don't want to get too sidetracked here, but both of them kind of fall into that same category for me as people that just have a different approach and much different personality, but they're just genius at certain things that they do well, and it's just really blows me away. I love talking to him, but more specifically to what's going on. We were talking about Russia before we went live, and I was telling you that I bought Lukoil and Sberbank the day that Russia went in and invaded Ukraine, and we're talking about the difference between buying that and then buying the RSX, which is the ETF, and that the RSX maybe not now, but it would at the time was a little less risky. So can you explain that to people, what the difference between the two, just so they can maybe learn that in the next time that we have one of the, hopefully we never will have another situation.
Hopefully never again.
But if we do, you're kind of better prepared.
Well, so this doesn't mean I'm actually right. This is my thinking. I was worried if I bought a bunch of GDRs, my broker would just liquidate me because U.S. government would say, in the interest of national security, we're going to sell Cuppy's position to an oligarch at a penny on the dollar. And that's how the U.S. government usually does stuff. I own a bunch of GDRs also. I played it really with a basket because I didn't know what was going to happen. I just know that if you buy a bunch of Russian assets down 90%, and Russian assets really are just a play on oil, and oil's gone sky high, and the ruble's collapsed, the costs have dropped, so the companies are making a lot of money. I just know if you bought it, even if they halted it, which I thought they would, and they have. At the end of the process, which might be a couple months, it might be a couple of years, if you look at World War One, they closed the market for 4 years. But when they reopen it, my companies will be very profitable in Russia. And so I bought some of the GDRs. I bought a lot more RSX. I figured it'd be harder to go after U.S., retail investors that bought, 100 shares of RSX and liquidated. Plus, it's a U.S. entity, that wraps these GDRs. I just thought it'd be harder for senators to say, we're going to liquidate grandma's RSX at the bottom versus, evil speculators like me get liquidated on my Sberbank or Lukoil or something. But in the end, I just played it as diversified basket because I didn't know what they're going to do. And I don't think these guys still know what they're going to do.
They say that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. I know you've been trading professionally for 20, 25 years. Have you seen a geopolitical situation that is similar to this that you've actually traded around?
No, I've seen nothing like this. I mean, I remember the Asian crisis, but they never halted the stuff. It just dropped 70% and kind of stayed down for a while. But that was a debt crisis. That wasn't a military crisis. I can't think of anything even close to this. You're talking about one of the largest countries in the world where they've frozen all trading. They've seized the central bank's assets. They've basically done everything they can to cut them off from the world. And I can't think of anything like this outside of World War One or Two. And I wasn't trading back then, but I've read about it, and they froze the markets. And that's kind of what they just did now.
Yeah, what's interesting, Cuppies? I spoke with Jim Rogers last night for about an hour and a half.
Okay, I know he's long Russia.
Well, yeah, I don't want to give it away because I'm going to be posting the interview tonight or tomorrow night.
Okay.
But you know, I really wanted to drill down on what he did, what he's doing now, and you know what, how he might play it in the future, because this is, as you know, this is his forte. I mean, he's been doing this stuff since the 1960s, specifically around geopolitical events and kind of this contrarian view. And one of the things that we discussed is back in the late 1980s, he was talking about Japan being in a bubble. And he was going to short Japan, but he was having second thoughts because he thought that Japan might change the rules exactly like what we've seen here with Russia, whether the U.S. government would, or, you know, he is more specifically worried about the Japanese government. But then he also used an example of Kuwait in 1982. And I don't know if you've heard this story.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, so it's fascinating. So Kuwait in 1982, they had a stock market. I'm sure it's still there today. But they started this scheme where they were allowing people to buy shares with post-dated checks. And like unlimited, like anyone could just post-date a check for $10 million and buy as many shares as they wanted. You know, it's almost like the GFC, you know, housing prices always go up, so who cares? And Jim was talking about how he was just chomping at the bit to short the market, but he didn't, because he was under the belief that even if he got his money in to short the market, he would never get his money out because of the politicians. And it just, you know, what made me realize is that if you go back and if you've got an understanding of history to the extent that Jim Rogers does, you tend to look at these situations through a little bit different type of lens, you know.
Yeah.
And he's just got a perspective and an experience and a wisdom that I guess money can't buy.
No, it's just experience. You got to be a history major to make money in the markets. The guys who build the spreadsheets never make any money.
Yeah. Now,
I'm thinking back to the other, this isn't like a communist revolution where they get rid of stocks and everything. This is, you know, this is like Venezuela. This is, you know, look at like Zimbabwe. Mugabe never took away anyone's shares. He just made them kind of worthless, but they kept trading. You know, Venezuela kind of the same, right? I don't think Putin's going to take my shares away. I'm really not worried about the Russian side. I'm terrified of the American side taking my shares away. But if you can hold it through this crisis, and eventually I think they'll find a resolution, they have to find a resolution, those shares are going to be very valuable. You know, I bought a bunch of Sberbank at 1.25 down from 20. I bought some Lukoil at 6 down from 100. You know, it's like, I don't think I'm going to lose money on these sort of things, you know? I bought some Fossagro at like $4, like it's down from like 50. I mean, the world's short of phosphate, even worse than oil right now. Like, I just think it's going to come out okay.
Do you think there would have been, for those who are more risk averse, but wanted to take advantage of you know, things that are cheap, let's say, or panic in the market, do you think there would have been an indirect way to play that? I'm thinking, you know, like wheat futures or maybe European stocks, or is there something like that
wheat went up massively, it's pulled back some, just like oil has gone up massively and pulled back some. European stocks have gotten hammered, but they're probably gonna, I guess, start rallying from here because they could do a bunch of stimulus. No, I think the trade is to buy stuff at 5-10 cents on the dollar and sit there and be patient. And you know, you just got to be patient. These things might not trade for a while. But
is there anything else specifically that you're looking at as an indirect way to play the Russian theme here?
Oh, absolutely. Uranium. They are about half the global enrichment. They're 10% of global production. So it's not, you know, it's a material number, but it's not massive. But in terms of enrichment, they're absolutely massive. And what's funny is that it's not the Russians cutting us off, though they probably are also. But, you know, Biden said that he wants to stop Russian exports and ban us from importing enriched material, which is kind of dumb because our power plants run on Russian uranium. Mm-hmm. And so if these guys actually ban this stuff, uranium is going to go sky high. In the weeks since they invaded, uranium's gone from $43 to $60. I think it's going to just keep going. There's a global shortage of uranium. the shortage could get much worse if we don't allow Russian exports. The Russians have already said they don't want to export anyway. I think Putin thought this thing through very well. You know, maybe his battlefield plan wasn't very good, or maybe this is the plan. I don't know. But in terms of the other pieces, I think he thought it through quite well. And he knows where he has power in this relationship. And I think by certain strategic minerals cutting us off, cutting the world off, he can cause an unbelievable amount of pain, just like, you know, we've done with sanctions back to him. And yeah. I think he'll press some pain points and force everyone to come to a resolution. You know, if he cuts off the world's neon, Russia and Ukraine produce 80% of the world's neon. You're never going to have another semiconductor produced in history. The world needs neon. It's this little tiny periodic element I've never even heard of before. I Googled it. There's no stockpiles. Without neon, you don't have semiconductors. You know, there's all these little things, and he's going to squeeze here, and he's going to squeeze a little there, and bring everyone to the table. I think he had a plan.
Yeah. Whenever I saw, you know, one thing I talked to Jim about is that there's so much propaganda on both sides. It's how on earth do you sift through all this to try to find the truth?
You know,
and, you know, that's one thing that kind of got my spidey senses tingling right from the beginning, is when I heard the media talking about how Putin is just this bull in a China shop, and he doesn't know, you know, he's just very reactionary and emotional, and he didn't think this through at all. That may be true, but I was like, boy, that's, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if that's completely accurate. You know, they talk about freezing the assets, and, you know, did he not see that one coming, or getting booted off the SWIFT system? Did he not plan for that in advance? I think these are open-ended questions that the media is just jumping to these conclusions, that there's just no way he thought of that, because he's just such a bumbling fool and just some megalomaniac. And I don't know.
Yeah, I don't really know either. Look, I think he expected sanctions. He expected all of his drinking buddies to have their yachts taken. You know, I think he expected a lot of this stuff. Maybe he didn't expect the full magnitude of what the West has done. But at the same time, you know, the West isn't even there uniform at this. The Germans still need their nat gas. It's winter still. You know, this cracks already all throughout all the alliances. And then you know, all this has done is made him closer with the Middle East, made him closer with India and with China, of course. I don't know. I think he sat there for 5 years game planning this on the financial side. For all we know,
stockpiling gold too, by the way.
Oh, of course. I mean, for all we know, this was all a plan to destroy Western hegemony and to destroy the U.S. dollar and, you know, destroy a bunch of things. For all we know, Ukraine was just bait, and we fell for the bait. I don't know if that's the truth, but I keep thinking about it, because it doesn't seem like he's trying to win the war.
Yeah. And you know, as someone who really follows commodities, how big of a deal is Russian oil to gas prices in the United States? Because you say, okay, well, we're sanctioning Russian oil. Is that a big deal? Maybe not, because it's only 3 to maybe 5% of our imports, if I'm understanding the data right. And, you know, how much can that actually impact prices at the gas pump over the long term? Is that a big deal, or is that not a big deal?
It's a very tight commodity market right now. There's not a lot of spare capacity. A couple of percent is where all prices get set on the margin. It's a commodity. 1-2% difference is the difference between oil going to, you know, zero and negative and to 1,000. So I think it matters, but it matters far more to our European allies, where they really need this natural gas. They really need the oil. They're far more integrated into Russia. But it's also all the other commodities. I think oil is kind of the big scary one that everyone's just kind of fixated on, but I'd be looking at neon, I'd be looking at argon, I'd be looking at uranium, all the other things where, you know, palladium, where he's much more dominant in his exports globally as a percentage of global trade, and we can't live without him. And I think those are the ones that really are going to end up mattering more. But yeah, oil, it's all gonna matter.
Is there a way to trade those themes specifically, like neon and argon?
I mean, look, they're small little industrial chemicals, or there's other companies in the United States that produce them. It's just going to take a year to, you know, basically grow the facility. It's a byproduct of something else. And so if you want to produce it, it's going to take a year. You have to build something. But, you know, the semiconductors, it's going to be a Q2 problem. And you know, we don't have a year. In terms of trading them, I don't know. I mean, you could go buy some canisters. I'm sure there's somewhere you buy it from. It's not what I do. But, I mean, I think my wife would get mad if I told her we stored some neon in the living room.
Yeah, we're going to flip it on eBay.
I heard there's a semi-fab in Taiwan that needs it. We're going to put it on eBay.
Yeah. All right. So from a psychological standpoint, how do you deal with losses or trades that go against you? What's your secret for that?
There is no secret. Losing money sucks. It's part of the game, though. I've done this for 20 years, and you know, every time you take a risk, you might lose. And I know when I show up to play this game, the odds are in my favor because I've done research and I have opinions and I have a lot of historical precedent. And I know that sometimes I'm just going to lose. And, you know, it's you're playing the odds. I've had a great 2 years in a row. I'm up this year. I could afford to take some losses. I'm up even after the Russian losses. I showed up knowing that, look, let's go back. I went into this Russian trade. I said, 10% chance he invades, 60% chance he swipes some those two provinces that no one really wants, and then 30% chance he's just kind of showboating because he's bored. You know, it's just kind of fun to move troops around the map. And I thought it was about a 10% chance, and I got the odds wrong, or maybe I got the odds right. And you know, the other nine times he wouldn't have invaded. But I said if he's going to invade, then I own a lot of oil, I own a lot of uranium. Well, those are going to go up more. And they did go up more. I'm up dollar for dollar many times, but I lost in Russia. And so it's all right. You know, it's a bad trade here. And I made, you know, three times over there.
Yeah.
That's kind of how you set up a trade, though, that if you get it wrong, you still get paid. That's what happens after 20 years of doing this. You kind of have these things offset.
And so it's a lot to do with diversifying and then position size, isn't it? Is that correct? And then what can people learn from this? From a standpoint of position size in their own portfolio?
Well, never risk your whole book. but no, in terms of position sizing, you have to be true with yourself of what are the odds this goes to zero? You know, anything goes zero. You know, we've seen large multi, you know, $100 billion companies in America go to zero in our lives. So this could happen. But you have to be true to yourself what you think the odds are of it going to zero, and you weight it accordingly. I do a lot of asymmetric investing. I'm looking for 5 and 10 baggers. I've hit, you know, a surprising number of them in my career. Then when I go into one of these investments, I really try to set it up so I can't lose. And that's really the hardest part, finding something where you're not going to lose much if you get it wrong. You can make a lot if you get it right. Like, let's go back to the uranium trade. I bought it at 31 when things were starting to get better. The supply deficit was really eating at the above ground physical stocks. We had this Sprott entity that was buying uranium every day. No one makes a profit at 31. But when it had been much worse 5 years earlier, when there were much larger deficits, uranium was 25. I kind of looked at this and I said, you know, physical uranium doesn't go to zero. I mean, anything go to zero, but it's unlikely. I said, when things were much worse, it was, you know, 20% lower. So I'm risking kind of 20% to make a couple 100%. I'll do that trade every day of my life because, you know, even if uranium prints zero, oil printed zero, like I own some physical uranium. It's going to be there in the morning. And so that's how you have to set trades up. It's you focus on the risk first and then think of the upside. And I've done this a very long time. I can't think of a broad-based ETF that's ever gone down 95% on me in a week. You learn something new every day of your life. But, you know, I size it appropriately so that I'm still up on the month.
So let's assume that this happens again in 5 years. You know, obviously, we pray that it doesn't, but something like this happens. What will the 5 year older Cuppy do based on having this experience now?
Dude, nothing different. I think I like the trade. Like I said, look, I approached the trade where I said the 10% chance he invades, oil is going to go screaming, uranium is going to go screaming. I'm going to make a lot of money and I'll lose a little money on my Russia. If he doesn't invade, you know, I bought a bunch of Russian stocks down by half. They were really cheap. I bought it at like 3x earnings or 2x earnings. Like, you know, I felt like they'd go back. You know, I bought RSX at 20. It's down from 35. I thought it'd go back to 35 or maybe even higher because in a commodity bull market, Russia is the best commodity producer. I thought I was buying at 20 on the way to 50. And maybe my oil and uranium would go up, but it'd take longer. Like, I felt like there was no way I could lose in the trade. And it kind of worked out like I expected it to, more or less. No, I do it exactly the same. I love this trade. And I still think I get paid on my Russia. It's just going to take some time.
Yeah. I think that the main takeaway there for me, as I hear you say that, is, you know, I've said this for a long time, and for some people it just sounds bizarre, but I said, you know, I think I'd actually rather lose money while sticking to my rules or my framework than to make money by breaking my rules. And, you know, I think probably goes back to playing blackjack in the early 2000s when I learned how to count cards. And I was just doing that to try to train my brain to think in terms of probabilities. But as you probably know, you know, you got basic strategy. So there's a right play and a wrong play for every single hand that you're dealt based on what the dealer is showing. And it's far better to lose money and make the right play based on the probabilities than to hit on a 19 and get a 2, you know?
Right.
So,
right.
And that's the example I always use. People say, oh, well, you know, aren't you concerned? Like, I've started selling my U.S. real estate in 2018. And I know you may have a different view on this, but in my world or in my mind, I'm like, okay, I bought it really cheap in 2012. And now it's getting kind of expensive, relatively speaking. And so I'm just start selling. I'm not going to sell it all at once, but I'm going to start selling it gradually just because it's simply expensive. And people say, well, you know, you're missing out on all these gains. I'm like, maybe, but just based on my framework, you know, if you're sitting at the blackjack table, you got a 19, you hit on 2, did you do the right thing or the wrong thing? And I think, you know, what you're saying there is you've got a specific framework and it's not going to change and it served you well. And therefore, you know, you made the trade based on your rules and it's the exact same thing that you would do 5 years from now.
Yeah, no, I think that's a perfect way to put it. You know, you set up a trade where in any scenario you make money, and you know, the scenario I didn't predict ended up being what happened and I made a bunch of money. It worked. You know, and that's if you value all my Russia at zero. And I think that there's going to be a recovery on that and potentially a very good recovery. But no, you always have to follow your rules. You always have to have a plan. You can't be emotional. You have to just think deeply, have a plan, and then go with your plan. And
okay. So there, I think I maybe missed a point there. So what you're saying is when you went in and bought the Russia, you had all these other trades where if those went to zero, the other trades would go up as and act as kind of a hedge.
Yeah, exactly. They offset. I mean, I made dollar for dollar more on uranium and oil than I've lost on Russia. If you value my Russia at zero, and you know, my prime broker might value it at zero. I came away from this thing up quite a lot, and there's a reasonably good chance that my Russia actually, it might take a couple of years, but it comes out the other side, and that's a better win. It was a, you know, scary couple days, weeks, but because I just didn't know what would happen. I still don't know what's going to happen to my Russia. But I set up a trade that I was going to make money pretty much no matter what happened. I mean, the only way I wouldn't make money is if J-Pow took rates to like 20% and, you know, crushed inflation, because I'm long inflation and I don't think he's going to do that. So I'm going to be just fine.
Yes. Okay. So, well, first of all, Josh, before we go any further, do you want to put a link in the description? So if anyone wants to ask a Cuppy a question, they can go ahead and kind of get in queue here. We've got time for that. And so let's maybe transition over to the Fed, because you've got this macro inflation theme. CPI just came out today at 7.9, and that includes the adjustments that they made back in January. Did you follow that at all?
I have not followed the adjustments. I just know that all the numbers are fake. If you could find me something that's up 8% in my life, I'd love to buy it only up 8. In my life, everything that I use on a day-to-day basis is up 25 to 50. Like, go to a restaurant, go to a bar, go buy yourself a nice home somewhere. Like, up 8, give it to me. I'll take it all day.
Yeah, well, I won't bore you with the details, but what one thing that they did, well, the main thing they did is change the weighting for the inputs to the CPI measurement. And as an example, they put a heavier weighting on owner's equivalent rents. And so, and as you know, this is a fake number. This is a number that they just kind of pull out of thin air. So they give that more weighting for obvious reasons, because they want the CPI down. They can just say, oh, well, this is, you know, we'll reduce the number from reality because we have so much control over it. Another thing they did is put more weighting on used cars, because obviously used cars ran so high and they're going to most likely come down. So that's going to add some deflationary, let's say, inputs to the overall metric or the overall measurement of CPI. And so my point there is this 7.9, if we would have had the same measurement that we used even back in December of 2021, would probably be, call it 8.1, 8.2. But I guess to your further point, it's more like probably, you know, 15% in reality.
Yeah. I mean, what do you feel like it is? You live in this world. I live in this world. Like when you go out to dinner, I mean, what's the price of a burger this year versus last year, or whatever it is that you consume?
Oh yeah, it's much, much higher. I mean, I'm in Medellin right now, and even when I was back in the United States, well, let me give you a great example. This place that I was renting in Phoenix, it was just kind of a condo at a nice place. So I was paying $5,000 a month for rent there, and just as I was leaving, the landlord was increasing the rent to $6,500. And it's just like, yeah, okay. You know, and then to your point, you're going out to a restaurant. But you know what's even more or just as impactful, I think, Cuppy, is in the United States, it's not that you're paying a higher price for everything, but in addition to that, the availability of supply is decreased significantly. So as an example, you're trying to get an Uber, and now instead of getting an Uber in a minute or two, it takes you 20 or 30 minutes. But yet, even when you do get the Uber, the price is even higher. And that's something that I think people need to consider when they ask themselves, you know, am I more or less wealthy than I was in 2019? That's kind of one of my themes, is that wealth isn't really a measurement of dollars. It's the access to goods and services. And even if your portfolio is significantly larger now than it was in 2019, if you have access to less stuff, then by definition, you are poorer. And I think that's really what's happened to the U.S. economy. But to answer your question further, even in Medellin here, when I first got back, Cuppy, a couple of weeks ago, that's what everyone's talking about. Price is this, price this, the price is high, the price of materials, the price of tile, the price of food, the price of absolutely everything is up here as well. So it's not just a U.S. phenomenon. What's different here, though, is the grocery stores don't have empty shelves like I saw back in the U.S.
Yeah. You know, I'm in Puerto Rico right now at a hotel. You go to the hotel, like half the things on the menu they don't have. You know, and the price is sky high of everything around here. It's sky high in Miami. No, there's real inflation, and it's just going to get worse. And, you know, I run a portfolio that's long inflation effectively, and it's been very good to me. You know, Jay Powell has made me a very wealthy man. I want to send him a Christmas card, you know? It's terrible for everyone else.
Yeah. What would make you change your view on inflation to where you said, okay, I need to set up my portfolio in a different way?
If they actually did something to stop inflation. I mean, I watch very closely because my portfolio is long inflation effectively. If they one day started talking about doing the things that reduce inflation, I get concerned. But it's very obvious why we have the inflation. It's very obvious that they're going to make it worse. You know, they're starting to talk about excess profits taxes on energy companies. Next is going to come to farmers and, you know, anything else. And then they're going to eventually go with price ceilings. And that's how you know you're going to have no gas at the station and, you know, nothing to eat and anything else when you just cap the price, because every country's done that. But they're talking about doing that.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to actually stop inflation, you know, if you think if you think right now inflation is really at 15 or 10 or whatever the number is, you need to take interest rates higher. You need to take interest rates to 20. And that will actually stop inflation in its tracks. You will have the mother of all economic crises. Every bank will fail. Every speculator will fail. You know, every guy long real estate, everyone will fail. You'll reset the whole system. but you'll solve the inflation problem. Instead, they're just going to chase inflation and chase. I mean, they're still printing money while they're talking about fighting inflation. It shows you where their head is. I mean, listen to the ECB. Those guys, they have rates at negative, and they're like, well, we're going to print a little bit less money next month. Like, that's going to help, you know? Yeah. So, like, let's forget even about interest rates. Let's just stop printing the money.
Yeah.
You know, they're so far behind. I like to say that, you know, like, basically, did you run a track in high school? Like, they've basically been lapped by inflation. They're so far behind that inflation caught them behind. You know, they're doing the mile. Like, I'm not very athletic, so I know how what it's like. You know, you're doing a 2.5 mile or something, and like the fast kid laps you, and you're just like, wow. Like, and then that's J-Cow. He's looking behind him, and he's like, I'm getting lapped here.
Right. Yeah, and they're just catching up to that person that's in front of them. And even if they do catch up, they still got another lap to go. It's just...
Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macro economics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out of control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level.
Do you think there's a possibility that they could stick the landing? And what I mean by that is, let's just say they take rates up to 1%. And as a result, the market gradually comes down. Let's say 20%, but over a 6 month period or a 9 month period or something like that. And because the stock market represents so much of the aggregate demand in the United States, that we don't get CPI down to, you know, 2%, but maybe we get it from 7.9 down to 5 or maybe 4, something like that, so they can kind of claim victory. Do you think that's possible, or it's kind of a black and white thing where if they raise it, the stock market crashes, and then they have to go back to a dovish, you know, QE of 120 back down to zero rates? Or they just let things run and we just get this inflation going from 7.9 to 9 to 10 to 12 to infinity and beyond.
Well, I think they're going to let it run. I think they're going to blame this all on Putin and say, because I mean, if you look at inflation, like oil is the biggest component of inflation. It comes into everything. I mean, the inflation you and I deal with, not like the fake number. And so if oil goes to 200 or 300 or 500, wherever it's going much higher. It's going to filter into everything in our lives. And that's going to move inflation dramatically. And they're just going to blame Putin. And they're going to say, oh, you know, bad man. And they're just going to ignore it. Jay Powell, look, he takes rates to, 1%. Like, the euro dollar is already saying that he's behind the curve if he only does one. It's already priced in. So if he only goes to one, like, if you look at what's happened with euro dollar, it's already basically already happened. It just hasn't happened in the real world. And so the rates have already tightened because they've talked some stuff. Look at where 10 years gone, this is tightening. Yeah. So there's already been tightening in the world and the Fed's behind their own, curves. And only 1% is going to do anything because we just saw some tightening. The market pulled off a bit, like the NASDAQ pulled off 20% and the Ponzi sector kind of detonated and a bunch of frauds blew up and Kathy's having a bad quarter, but Chase is having a bad quarter. Like all the really fraudulent assets are falling apart. But I don't think that's going to matter because what's happening in one guy's portfolio, I don't think it changes anything. In the end, inflation is caused by printing money, interest rates, and government meddling in the free market, which makes everything inflationary. If they were to allowing people to build pipelines, if they were not canceling drilling permits, And if they were not talking about carbon taxes and penalizing oil producers, and if they were letting the banks lend to oil producers, we'd have plenty of oil in this country. We have we're very lucky that we have so much oil in this country. You just aren't allowed to get it out of the ground. There's all these things that the government, by meddling, has created inflation. And that's all throughout the supply chain. You know, they were doing the stimmies a year ago. My friends told me they couldn't find workers for anything. They're building homes and no one shows up to work because they're making more stimmies.
Yeah, you still can't find workers in the States, Cuppy.
Right. Well, I mean, we're having a housing crisis. The population grows every year. You have a housing crisis. You can't fix the housing crisis because you can't get people to build homes. You can't get people to work at the lumber mill. That's why the price of lumber went crazy. Like, you do all these things and it just, you know, it's an integrated economy. It's a global economy. And when you break a few pieces of it, the whole thing breaks.
Yeah.
And, it's inflationary. I mean, why are home prices going up? Because, you know, there's 5 million shortage of homes. There's 5 million families that need a home and they don't exist. So they're bidding up the ones that do exist. So that's what's causing the inflation. It's government incompetence and meddling. And these guys don't seem like they're looking for solutions. They're looking to make more mistakes and blame people.
Yeah.
So, I think long inflation is the trade.
Yeah. It's very consistent with another thing that I was pointing out a month ago or so when they were talking about the numbers were showing that we have the biggest labor shortage in human history. And while we have the biggest labor shortage in human history, the administration is coming out and forcing vaccine mandates on employers. So to literally fire 10 or 15% of your staff when we got 11 million job openings in the United States. It's just absolutely, it's madness, really.
It's truly madness. The guys running this country, and this isn't just a poke at Biden. I think we've had multiple bad presidents in a row. And it's the whole political establishment. I mean, most of them are in their 80s. They've been screwing up our country before I was born.
Yeah.
And it's very Pavlovian. Because they have not gotten fired for screwing things up, they think they're doing a good job, or they at least get reelected and they get to steal money and they're happy and they get reelected and, you know, they've gerrymandered all the districts. They can't lose. But a lot of these people literally have been screwing up this country before I was born, and they're going to keep screwing it up for another 15, 20 years till they die. These people at 80 probably have another decade.
Well, what do you think about that deal on Reddit where they were just going long whatever Nancy Pelosi bought?
That's probably a good trade. I mean, she's one of the best performing hedge fund managers in the world. Pelosi Capital Management is like it's outperformed almost everything else. I mean, the nerve of her to buy, call options in Tesla. I understand if you buy like the S&P and you say, I believe in America and American progress and prosperity. But to buy options on Tesla, like a company that like only exists due to government stimulus, government graft and, handouts. And
artificially low rates, yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing is ridiculous. No, I don't think congressmen should be allowed to trade. You know, if you own some stocks and you get elected, you can hold those stocks. They shouldn't be allowed to trade. The whole thing's it's so ridiculous and rigged. I mean, look, if I trade on information I'm not supposed to have, I go to prison. They know who's getting which stimulus. It's terrible. Let's not go down the rabbit hole of the government. I think we all kind of are annoyed with the government. But going back to your question, I think inflation's here to stay and it's going to get worse because they show no desire to fix the problem. And they seem to be focused on making it worse. We've seen this in a lot of Latin American countries where they make things terrible. Then they make it so bad that a reformer comes in, he fixes it, things get better, and the cycle is like a 20-year cycle in Latin America forever and ever. And, we've had it too long, too good in this country for too long, so that when they break it, it takes longer to fully break, but it's going to break.
Yeah. What do you make of the idea that gas prices go so high because of oil prices going so high that puts a pinch on disposable income so people don't have money to buy other things, which could, and a lot of times does, cause a recession?
Yeah, I think that's somewhat inevitable. But I would say that I know my politicians, and they will give gas stimmies out. They will send you a check, card, or an EBT, or whatever it is. You know, they've already gotten rid of state gas taxes. The next thing they're going to do is say, hey, Cuppy, here's 25 free gallons. Just do something with them. But I don't use 25 gallons every month. I don't know. Set them on fire. Have a bonfire. Like, just use yours. Take them. You know, I could see a world where oil's 200 and the United States actually uses more oil than and dramatically more. You know, we're like 21, 22 now. I can see us at 30 million barrels of consumption a day with oil at 200, given the stimmies. And
that's a good point. I didn't think of gas stimmies. Yeah, that's a great point.
What we've seen is in Venezuela and Iraq and Saudi. I mean, look at Saudi. I have a friend. He said, the gas is so cheap, you turn your air conditioner on and you leave the door open because you don't even care. The power is just so cheap. That's what happens when there's no price mechanism. And they're already starting the stimmies. I mean, look what they did with Europe because they screwed up their power grid so much. They're now giving everyone stimmies for electricity. Well, what do you think is going to happen to electricity demand when it doesn't cost you anything? It's the same thing. Politicians always make the same mistakes. It's very predictable. So, no, I don't think it's going to do much here. It may do stuff in other countries, but in America, we can print the money. And if you can print money, you can effectively get more gas.
Yeah, that's a great point. All right, buddy, I know that you're there in a hotel, and I want to be cognizant of your time. We've got a caller here.
So sure.
Do you want to put him up? Anthony, what's up? Hey, what's going on, my friend? You're on with Cuppy.
Yeah, I just want to give you a little anecdotal piece of labor shortage. My little brother works probably 10 hours a week at a lumber yard. Just got $1,000 bonus to stay for the next summer.
Awesome. Good for him.
I know, totally. Throw it in the stimmy. Thanks, guys. Talk to you later.
All right. Thanks, Anthony. There you go. What's crazy is you people can see it all around them. And so I think that makes them even more irate when the politicians come out and say that it doesn't exist, or when the Fed or the, whoever does the CPI number, when they come out and say that it's 7.9, I think that makes people even more angry because they know that it's such a farce.
Yeah, no, I think everyone knows inflation is up. Look, my mom doesn't follow anything in finance, but she called me bitching the price of broccoli is up. And she goes, why is broccoli up? I'm like, I don't even know the price of broccoli, Mom. I don't think I've ever bought broccoli in my life. clearly it's up enough that got her mad, you know? And look, even 7.9, the Fed's mandates too. They failed. Like, whatever. It's ridiculous. Just be long inflation. You can make a lot of money.
All right, well, let's talk about that. We know oil is a way to play inflation. We know that you're very bullish on uranium, but is that a way to play inflation, or is that more just because this ESG movement is going to push everything towards a quote-unquote green energy, and uranium or nuclear is the only thing that falls into that category? And then what other things are you doing along this inflation theme?
So I think uranium is going to work because it's suddenly green. I never thought my portfolio would become ESG. That's never in my wildest dreams. If you have a commodity where you consume 185 million pounds a year and you produce 150, eventually you're going to run out of stuff in the warehouse. And I think that's kind of happening right now. And if Putin cuts off a bunch of warehouses, so to speak, it's going to accelerate. So, no, I really like that trade. And a nuclear power plant is a $10 billion piece of equipment. It becomes a paperweight if you don't have uranium. So they'll pay almost any price. I really like that trade. I think Sprott Physical Uranium is the best way to play it. And I own a lot of that. What I've done for the rest of my inflation trade is I've looked at other inflations in history. And every inflation is caused by different stuff. And it's kind of manifested in different ways.
Yeah.
And I think this inflation is going to be unique because the Federal Reserve will keep rates artificially low, and they'll have some justification, but they'll keep rates low. And unlike, say, Zimbabwe, where they kept rates low, but, you know, rates were a couple 100% and inflation's 1,000, and, you know, it's kind of like a fake country in a way. because it's the U.S. and, you know, the Europeans will be like, well, that makes sense. And, you know, and the Brits will be like, okay. You know, the Canadians, like everyone will kind of play the same game because they all went to the same like five schools together. And, you know, they all go have a steak dinner once a quarter. Like they'll all play the same game. And so they'll all keep rates low while inflation goes high. And I think the way you're going to play it this cycle is U.S. housing because there's already a shortage. I do a lot of commodity stuff. You know, U.S. housing, it's a commodity. Look, it's
yeah, right.
You know, people like to claim it's not, but it's a commodity. I think there's a huge shortage of U.S. housing. It's 5 million units shortage. I think the shortage is higher because people are leaving high tax states. And so, you know, you're going to have plenty of extra homes in California. You're going to have a shortage in Texas and Florida and Tennessee. And, you know, people are moving to suburbs because cities just are going bad right now. So I think it's probably more than the 5 million like government number. It's probably 7 or 8.
How are you playing that, Cubby? Because I heard you talking about this with Jack, with Jack Farley, I believe.
Okay, yeah. I chat with him about this. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a great conversation.
Thanks. I mean, the way I'm thinking about this, though, is if the Fed keeps rates low and let's say home prices go up 20% a year, which is basically what's been happening for years and years, but you could finance it and maybe a 30-year cost you 5% versus 3% last year. Well, you make 1,500 points. And 1,500 points is a lot because you got to put 20% down. So, you know, you're getting 4 or 5 turns on your money and you're making 60% a year on your capital. And then you put it up on Airbnb and you make some more money. I think a lot of guys are going to buy a second home. They're going to buy a vacation home. You know, people are going to, you know, spec on a home. And people say, you know, home affordability is way too high. And it is way too high. But that's in California. That's in, you know, Manhattan. Like, go to Texas. You know, $500,000 gets you a lot of home. And you're going to see people who have decent jobs that are going to be able to afford the down payment. And they're actually going to save a bunch of money because, you know, whatever, you know, a couple $100 a month in mortgage payment, they're going to more than make that up in the state tax. And so I don't feel like homes are expensive right now, actually. I think homes are quite cheap, actually. It's just, you know, coastal cities. And so the way I'm playing this is the companies that sell products that go into a home. Home building is a terrible business. Low return on capital, high capital intensity, you get margin squeeze. But take a look at something like Builders FirstSource. They are selling lumber. They're selling windows. They're distributing the goods that go into a home. Well, inflation's on your side. They have fixed the SGA to run the facilities. And the more stuff they sell, you know, when demand for, you know, lumber and tiles, the demand goes up, well, they sell more of it. But what's really happening is pricing's going up. So the gross margin dollars, the actual gross margin is expanding, but the gross margin dollars are really expanding. And the SGA is kind of staying fixed. And the net result is they're having huge growth of earnings. I mean, look at Builders FirstSource. It trades at like 5x earnings, 5x cash flow. You know, maybe 4x, maybe 6x, like who really knows? But they're buying back 5% of the company each quarter and the return on capital is 40. I mean, these are like tech sort of return on capital numbers, but you got to get at a low single digit earnings multiple and it's growing, you know, decently. It's I think businesses like that, where they're going to buy back 20% of the company each year and grow 10, 15 organically each year. So you get 30% growth, like on a shareholder basis, you come into it 4x with a low return on capital. I think these businesses are great because as the inflation goes through, the gross margin dollars will keep going through, even if total volumes don't go through. I mean, it's going so great. One of my top five positions was acquired this week. A PE firm came in with an unsolicited takeover offer. They gave me 60% more than the price. I'm pissed, actually. You know, even though it was a nice takeout, I think 4x earnings is cheap to sell one of these businesses. But, you know, private equity, they're not dumb. They like making money. Like, and yeah. So they can recognize how good these businesses are going to be. And I think that's the way you play this. All the companies, the Boise Cascades of the world and the Blue Links of the world and all the companies selling into the supply chain. I think that's where you want to be.
What about Home Depot?
I mean, look, it's a massive company that's down a bunch. It's profitable. But where's it going to go from here? You know, you're going to get maybe 50%. Like, I don't know. Like, I like little tiny companies. I mean, my Builders is a $12 billion market cap. They make $1 billion every quarter. You know, like Blue Links, it's less than $1 billion market cap. It's basically a duopoly in terms of distributing lumber supplies. You know, like, I like those sort of things. I like my Cornerstone. I wish they didn't take it from me. It's a $3 billion market cap.
Yeah.
I think they're going to do $900 million of EBITDA this year. It's the largest producer of vinyl windows. You know, you don't have a home without vinyl windows, you know, siding, all these things. Like, it's a dominant, great little business. That's how I'd be playing it, because they have a 5 million home backlog to build. And if I know anything about our government, they're going to give out all sorts of stimmies to people that need homes.
Yeah, right.
That's a crowd pleaser for everyone. And we can print the money, so we can print homes effectively. They're going to give everyone stimmies.
Yeah, that makes sense for sure. Do those companies have specific exposure to those red states, or are they just national?
They're national, but if you look at these companies, they're in the states that are growing. I mean, do you really want to be distributing lumber and building supplies in Maine? Like, it's not going anywhere. You know, you want to be all throughout the Sun Belt. That's where the growth is happening. So that's where these guys are, and that's where the growth is. If I throw one more stock at you, my favorite position, my second largest position after uranium, Sprott Physical Uranium, is a company called St. Joe. They're one of the largest owners of land in the state of Florida on the panhandle. Read the Q4 numbers. It's absolutely booming. They're selling lots. They're monetizing their land, and they're using the money to buy commercial real estate. It's, I think, one of the cheapest stocks in the galaxy right now, and it's growing like crazy. I think you're basically buying a portfolio for 25 cents to the dollar. And I think very good things are about to happen. I mean, good things keep happening to Florida. It's just going to get better.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I was even listening to Tom Woods the other day, and he was saying that there's some group that's talking about Florida seceding. And I know that's a low probability, but just you know, the fact that they're going that direction. I know DeSantis just came out and announced that Florida, or his Surgeon General or whatever, announced that Florida is going to be the first state that's going to not suggest that parents vaccinate their kids, you know. And it, for you and I, it sounds kind of like a no-brainer. But, you know, in the political environment we live in today, that's really kind of making a statement.
Yeah, but I mean, these kids are too young to make a decision for themselves. They're at zero risk. And who knows what sort of, you know, 10, 20 years from now these vaccines will do to these kids. I mean,
I agree completely. Yeah, but for a governor to come out and say that, you know, he's just going to be completely attacked by the media, which I'm sure he was. He knows all this, but the fact that he's taking that stance shows that he's willing to go in a completely different direction.
Right. No, I think that's good. Look, Florida has been one of the most open states since this whole thing started. I remember COVID, you know, we had COVID, and then for about a month, we all kind of like hid in our apartments, and then for about a month, everyone walked around like idiots with their masks on. And then it got to be about May, and DeSantis is just like, we're done with this. Like, this is and, you know, like, I had friends coming from Manhattan. I mean, not even like in 2020, because I mean, COVID ended in May of 2020 in Florida. But I had friends coming, like, you know, I was in Miami in January. Friends are coming to visit me, and they're wearing masks in the car with me. And I'm just like, you guys do that still? Like,
yeah,
like, it's ridiculous. Oh, by the way, so in Puerto Rico, they finally got rid of all the mask mandates. And,
oh, did they?
Yes, yesterday. COVID ended at midnight yesterday. It's official. I'm allowed back into restaurants again.
Oh, man. Okay, so good. Then I'm going to take a trip back there again, because I've got so many friends there. You know, I'd love to hang out with you, grab dinner. I had dinner with one of the guys that works with you last time I was there visiting Mark Moss.
And oh, great. I was with
Griff and Brent Johnson, and there's just so many great people there. Yeah, and that's kind of what I was waiting for, is just for the insanity to kind of settle down there a little bit, because they were way over the top. I mean, they had taken it to like Australia and Canada levels there.
Yeah, they did. They did. And I said they'd be the last, and they were the last. I don't think there's any other state with mandates anymore. You know, my wife and I like to say that Putin cured COVID. He deserves some sort of Nobel Prize for that. But he did. He cured COVID. In 2 weeks, he cured it. All the media started focusing on some other thing. And they gave all the governors like cover to be like, this is dumb, guys. Like, stop wearing diapers in your face. This is stupid. Yeah. So Putin cured COVID. Puerto Rico finally got done with it. And, you know, I'm allowed.
Even in San Juan, they don't have like the curfew and the mask mandate, the vaccine card and everything, or the passport.
Perlucci got rid of it. He put out a press release on Monday, I think. But as of midnight last night, I'm allowed into restaurants again. So I'm super excited about this all. I'm going to go tear it up this weekend.
Just out of curiosity, what are the people there doing? Because it seemed like they were really under the spell. I mean, I was there, this would have been December, I think. And there were still people that were literally wearing a mask while riding around on a motorcycle by themselves.
Well, I mean, I was at the beach today. There's still people in the water wearing a mask. They're like waist deep in the water. They're wearing a mask. Like, but you know, it's a free country. And if you want to look like an idiot, there's no one who's going to stop you. I would say that it's very different. So you didn't spend enough time in Rincon, but San Juan was where they really focused these mandates. Rincon is very much live and let live. Laid back attitude. I'd say no one wears masks. I mean, the cops weren't wearing masks. The cops weren't enforcing anything. My friends in San Juan were scared because they were giving out $1,000 tickets. And in Rincon, no one cared. I mean, I'd say about half the restaurants didn't care, you know.
It wasn't a big deal.
It's a smaller community. Everyone kind of knows each other. And, you know, the great thing about it, though, is that we did a lot more barbecuing at my house. we had one party. We had like 50 people come over. It was great. You know, like that's how you should treat a crisis.
Lemons into lemonade. That's right. So how are you doing on the building?
Oh, our office building?
Yeah.
Well, if you can find someone who has floor-to-ceiling windows, I will give you money. I will give you my car. But whatever you want, I will give it to you.
So you can't get the windows?
No. We backordered these windows, and I don't know what the problem is, but there are no windows to be had on this island for any amount of money.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that you're seeing the same types of things in the United States as well. So it doesn't surprise me that you're seeing it in Puerto Rico. What about, last couple things here. My camera keeps going out. Sorry. But what about coal and shippers?
I think coal will do very well. So coal, look, the price of coal is sky high. It's probably going to decline from here. Coal has a cycle, but I don't think it's going to decline rapidly. And so the price of coal staying at these levels is very profitable for everyone. I think coal, put it this way, when's the last time anyone's ever said, I want to lend money to a guy building a coal mine? Like, where does the money come from? Like, who's building a coal mine? Like, which government's permitting a coal mine? You know, so no, I think coal's going to stay high because in the end, the world is using more coal this year than last year. And next year, the world will need more coal. And people forget the fact that we keep using more coal. And where is it going to come from?
All energy. You know, I had a do you know Art Berman, Cuffy?
Yeah, no, I know of him. Yeah.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And I spoke with him the other day and he pointed out something that I didn't realize, that every single time that we transition to a new energy source, the demand for the prior energy source continues to grow.
Yeah.
So as an example, we use more wood today than we used back when that was our main energy source. We use more coal. He says the demand never goes down, even if you move on to a higher density source.
Right. And so, I think coal is going to be a good place to put some money. And I mean, what's amazing is these companies trade for 1x earnings. Like, it's not very demanding if you get it wrong. We were asked about oil. I've got what else?
Tankers.
Tankers, the problem with tankers, they built too many of them, and it's a commodity. And so when you build too many of them, and then the Russians cut off exports of oil, well, then you have tankers and no product to move around, and the rates suck. And the rates spiked quite recently because there's been a lot of disruption with what Russia's doing. But new trade routes will develop. They always develop. The Greeks are the best at this, and they own most of the tankers. And they'll figure out how to make the logistics efficient. And I think rates, you need more scrapping. And if you wanted to be anywhere, I'd be in clean tankers rather than dirty. I think clean is looking better, and I own a couple. But no, it's not where I put my energy right now. I think I put my energy in nuclear. I think uranium is just about to go crazy. I think it's going to be the biggest squeeze of all time because a lot of the producers are short. A lot of the utilities normally run with 3 to 5 years of inventory. They're at 2 years. So let's say they're effectively short. And a lot of the finance guys, they're all short. You know, the guys doing the carry trade, they basically, sell deferred into the spot market. They buy other deferred. But if Russia cuts them off, they're all short. I think it's going to make GameStop look kind of benign and boring.
Yeah. And the way you're playing that, to be clear, is through Sprott.
I own Sprott. I also own some Kazatomprom, which is the Kazakh. It's the largest producer of uranium in the world, the lowest cost producer. But you take some, you know, Kazakh political risk and corporate governance risk. And so, no, it's a small position, but my main position is Sprott. I like that trade.
All right, man. I'll let you get back to your family. I
sincerely appreciate it.
For the viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go? I know Twitter, and you've got a blog, I believe.
Yeah, go to Adventures in Capitalism. It's a free product, so you get what you pay for. But we flag a lot of these trends for a decade. And let me give a quick plug. Go to kedm.com. Kedm is a service I have that tracks event-driven trading, and we track about 20 event-driven strategies. It's a free trial, and I don't think once you take the trial, I don't think you'll ever be able to go back, because we flag so many great event-driven opportunities. So kedm.com.
And what's your Twitter, Cuppy?
At H Cuppy.
Okay. Great, man. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
Thanks.
And we'll have to do it again soon.
Great. Awesome. Hopefully we can meet you in Puerto Rico soon.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
All right. Bye.